Racine Dairy, and then I managed a Jersey dairy, so I've got the dairy background, but then I spent 4 years managing a Cole Herford cow-calf operation of 150 brood cows. So my love is in the cattle world. I'm here because I believe we have to protect our most valuable resource to our people in this country. So I thank you as well for participating in this session. Here's how Chicago prepares for a problem. I went through the Chicago O'Hare Airport, and I saw this these cows they had in there prepared for an emergency, so I thought this would be an example of where we're trying to go through this presentation. I want to start, as Renee said, back up just a couple of minutes to the presentation that I made this summer for you in Reno, and just hit a couple of the highlight slides from that presentation for those who weren't able to be there and for the benefit of review as well. We talk about having a complete system in North Carolina, a set of SOPs, standard operating procedures, for every aspect of an emergency. Now, that's hundreds of pages of detailed information about how to respond, whether it's a natural disaster, a disease, or a terrorist event. So of those, in every situation, we have an activation response cascade. You can see we start with level 4, which is a heightened sense of awareness, come to level 3, restricted movements, level 2, which is a confirmed positive, and then level 1, which is a statewide and national emergency. Under level 3, when we start to feel like we have a problem, I gave a talk about involving the media. You can see media presentations and briefings begin in level 3. The media can be our friend or our foe. So what we've got to do is get ahead of the curve. They can actually get way ahead of us in an emergency. Any kind of exercise we've done in North Carolina, we've seen they can actually drive the exercise by what they tell the public. If we don't get out there and educate them ahead of time, long before an event, and then participate with them during an event. So what we do is we put together all the major radio and TV and print media, tell them they're an essential component of the team, show them how they can hurt the state if they don't participate, and then let them know they're the experts at communicating the information that we need, so we get buy-in from them and do this not during an emergency, but right now before we have a problem. As I indicated, the media can hurt by spreading the disease, so we put together a media setup program for quarantined areas. And we want to make sure that we restrict the airspace that they might travel into, and we put together a media crew that represents all the different medias. Not unlike what happened last night in the President's address to Congress. It was not all the media folks in there. They put together a pool. So what we've done is develop a pool participated sort of way to keep from having too many people trying to come in and out and therefore spread the disease. You want to be a part of the media's briefings. So be a part of all designated briefings and don't put it off. If we put it off, the media feels like we're hiding from them. We're not hiding. Sometimes we're just so busy we feel like we can't get around to it. So make sure in your state you designate somebody to participate with the media. I want to start by also backing up to another talk that I gave this summer at your meeting about terrorist activities and how we can be a target of those activities. As you can see from this slide, 27 states receive animals from North Carolina. Other countries like Puerto Rico, Mexico, the Caribbean, South America, out all the way to the Pacific Rim. You can draw this same set of arrows coming out of any state represented in this room by any of you. Go home. I just challenge you to go home and draw the arrows and look at how much you move animals and products out of your state. It's phenomenal. It's phenomenal. So what we've got to do is recognize that terrorists are paying attention to this. They're looking at ways to spread their terror, their fear, that they could compromise our food production capabilities in this country, and they're looking at things like this. And so we need to look at this and say, that's a big bullseye to a terrorist in terms of how they could hurt us. And you can see from this slide exactly how animals move out of our state. We put together a reporting system that's just about instant. As soon as the lab detects a positive in our state, we generate a map that's around that place, and we go out by fax, emails, phone calls, whatever, with this map and a letter that says, an electronic letter that says, this has been diagnosed in your area to all the farmers that we know in that particular area. We have a geographic information system that we have the farms located on so that farmer gets notified within hours. really, we can do it within an hour of any kind of situation. We built this for our everyday diseases, and we practice using it every day so that in an emergency situation, we can notify all those in the area of the potential risk that they might encounter. We've also put together a state animal response team. Hurricane Floyd really kicked us, and we didn't want to have to go down that road again, so we realized that emergency management needed help from a public-private partnership, so we put together a state animal response team. We have 42 partners, both public and private entities, in this group, and what this does is collect together all the resources that would be needed to respond to any kind of event in cattle so that we can put those resources all in one place. We had folks with horse trailers, for instance, carrying cow feed to cattle that were stranded during a flood. So you see how you can put this 1 + 1 = 3, the synergy of different species together in an emergency and have a much more effective response, and that's what we're doing with our state animal response team. One of the things I mentioned this summer is also mortality management. If we don't determine ahead of time how we're going to deal with the mortality involved in an emergency, then again the media or other folks actually make that determination in the moment in a chaotic situation, and we don't have as good of a solution as if we sit down with all the different folks, the stakeholders, including air quality, water quality, public health, and put together a policy in your state that is reasonable for an emergency. It's not the same policy that's used day in and day out. It's an emergency. It's going to be more than we can handle. And public health and air quality and water quality can think that way most effectively if we develop those sorts of procedures for how to handle mortality prior to an event. We've also, with our state animal response team, put together a code of conduct. We want our volunteers, and you're going to need a lot of them in any kind of emergency, to stay on task. We do not need folks with other agendas out there taking pictures and trying to run down the people who are trying to produce the food for all of us to eat. So if we have a code of conduct in our state, and if someone's activated in a volunteer organization and they cannot follow that code of conduct, then they're asked to be deactivated as well. So it's a way to keep people and organizations on task that you would appreciate when you're trying to save our food production capabilities in an emergency. County animal response teams, the local response is the most effective response. We've seen floods in our state. The better prepared the county is to respond to animal emergencies, the better we protect our most precious assets, our food. These county animal response teams need everybody. They don't just need the farmers and the veterinarians. We also need the Red Cross. We need the fire department, the sheriff, emergency medical services. You can see the different groups listed here. Extension, for instance, very effective in our county animal response team. Get everybody involved. Build a plan. Exercise that plan ahead of time. Again, the best way to respond effectively in an emergency is to prepare ahead of time, and the best preparation is on the county level. Here's a map of North Carolina, and you can see how we're preparing. Here's the 100 counties. The red counties don't have a team yet. The yellow counties have a team in place, and they're working on a plan. The green counties have a completed plan that's been signed off on by local emergency management. And the blue counties are the counties that have exercised that plan. A very simple way to move forward the local response on a statewide basis. And you will need this. You will need this not just preparing on your farms, but also for your community and your state. Because believe me, in any kind of emergency, the state and the county are going to have their hands full trying to address the human concerns. And so we've got to have our own abilities to respond to animal emergencies. We build capability by putting together a roster in North Carolina of people all across the state who can respond during an emergency to an animal event and what their capabilities are. This roster is on a protected website where you can only access with a password, and that gives us an ability to know who to communicate with during an emergency. I also challenge you by this slide to participate in any kind of emergency exercise that is going on in your state. you go to the fire department and you participate, and you get them thinking about, now, how are we going to protect our most valuable asset, our beef cattle, in this, in our community or in our state? By your participating with them, then they start thinking about and developing plans, again, to protect our most valuable asset, our beef cattle. Think farmland security. We talk about homeland security. I like to talk about farmland security. Think about how a hazard might slip in on you. Do a disease assessment and prevention plan. Do a threat analysis and threat reduction plan. I'll show you what these look like in a moment. Develop tamper-resistant farms. We know about tamper-resistant containers for pills. We've got to put into place tamper-resistant farms. And exercise your plan. If you exercise, you get stronger. We know that about our muscles. We've got to do that as it relates to emergencies as well. Place no trespassing signs and screen your visitors. Isolate and feed your new stock. Develop a decontamination rate on your farm. Signs educate. Lots of farms think it's too much to put up signs. We know that from our involvement with foot and mouth during the last few years, the more signage, the better. Again, biosecurity, not bioterrorism. Know the risk associated with fairs, with travel, particularly abroad, with petting zoos, and with international events. International events bring lots of people to our states, and they also come with their ethnic foods, with their clothing, with their gear, which could bring in diseases to our states. Participate and know what these international events are like. Know where these petting zoos are going and getting animals from, and develop an understanding in your state of the risk associated with these things. Purchase your pet from a known source. You can bring in a foreign animal disease in a pet that's brought to your farm. Purchase your stock from a reputable known source. Control strays and wildlife. Screen and educate your farm workers, their clothes. Their respiratory tracts can house diseases for a couple of days. So know where they've gone and make sure that they stay off that farm for a few days if they've been places where there are foreign animal diseases. Pay attention to the food and the vehicles that they bring on your farm, because they can bring something, a food that could actually be carrying the foreign animal disease onto your farm. And here's another way we protect our farms. We have, I'm just showing you a few examples here on farm protection. A waiver. This waiver says, I've not been out of the United States, nor has someone in my immediate family within the last 5 days. It's all part of an education tool. Let's have a common sense approach to on-farm protection and biosecurity. Lock your gates, put barriers to entrance, secure your feed stuff, pasture your animals off road if possible, and consider some additional security items, and I'm going to show you a couple of those. Here's examples: power wash. Everybody needs a power wash. You can't go through an emergency of a disease nature without one. Surveillance cameras. This is a couple of things that some folks in the business continuity area for large corporations who've reviewed some of our farm plans for us. We've got some folks in the security area actually looking at farms, and they've said, here's a good example of something that's very inexpensive. And I've had one farmer put this in, and he actually caught an employee stealing from him. So these sorts of things can be used for domestic reasons, as well as being paying attention to who might be bringing something onto your farm. Here's another one that the experts gave me: laser notifications, a little laser beam going across the road that tells you when somebody's coming onto your premises. Biosecurity is a teamwork effort. It's a community effort. We've got to educate the neighborhood that we live in of the threat that we're facing. We've got to tell them how important it is for them to participate in this threat, because we need them to keep from bringing these sorts of things to us. They travel abroad. They live right next to some of our farms. They can create a risk that none of us in this country could live with if a disease was spread by an intention. The more eyes and the more ears, the more security. The more eyes and the more ears, the more security. Tell you a little story about why that's important to involve the community. In 1984, before the Olympics in California, some housewives were looking out of their windows doing the dishes, and they saw some guys doing some funny things walking around their neighborhood. well to see how to do this. Don't move suspects. Don't leave your farm or welcome visitors if you have a suspect. Get your local veterinarian and law enforcement involved early. Practice your exit advice by security, and obviously don't feed scraps and garbage. Early detection is critical for disease. We have a website at our Department of Agriculture that gives reportable diseases. You can go on it and you can click through and you can actually study the diseases, see all kinds of pictures and information so that everyone, again, the more eyes, the more ears we have, the better detection we will have. So these sorts of websites that show us and educate all of us as to what the potential threats are, the better prepared we are. You can see here's an example of a click through on our website as to how someone can actually learn more about these kinds of diseases. We don't want cows to fly. We don't think that's the way to do it. We certainly don't want people to come in and bring some sort of organism into our country, a disease that would spread in the wind as well and destroy our food. Here's another simulation that I want to show you. You can see the days changing and the number of infected states down in the lower left corner. The arrows going across our country are showing disease spread. This is a simulated model. Day 13, 37 states infected. What you can see here is the number of states are increasing as each day goes forward. Even if there was national stop movement in this particular graphic, on day 5, and if stop movement was declared nationally by day 8, there would be a potential of losing 23 million animals. I'm going to run this again if I can. You can see it, day 1, Paris infecting 5 states. Day 5, you can see it's in 19 states, and the disease, oops, was detected. Anyway, the take-home message here is, by day 5, when the disease is detected, the markets are diving. It's in 27 states. Your national organization's on the phone. The governor's on the phone. Congress is convening about this. FEMA's talking about a national disaster. The president's thinking about, what do we do? This is just an example of how terrorists could start with 5 states, and by the time we recognize that we're in 27 states, and by the time we do a stop movement, you can see we're in 37 states. The reason I showed this simulation, and I'm going to tell you a little bit more about it in just a second, is to make this point, and this slide and this point is the most important thing I can share with you today, and that is we can't just be preparing for biosecurity on our farms. We've got to recognize that if it is a terrorist event, it's going to be a national event, and it's going to involve 30, 40 states. We've got to prepare as farmers and producers our states to respond. And our nation to respond. It will be a national event. This is a homeland security issue. And we've got to involve ourselves not just with biosecurity on our farms, but biosecurity of our nation. Just like we as a nation go out and purchase F-15 planes to protect our nation from any sort of terrorist because it's a national protective mechanism. We've got to have in place this kind of protection because a disease like this will go to every state. It will not just be in the top 5 producing beef states. As you can see, it's going to be in 40 states. So even every state needs to be considering this and the impact it will have on every state. Also, by the time it's detected, USDA could easily be tapped out with its resources if we had this many states involved. So you can imagine how important it is for us to develop our own in-state and local capability to respond, because if we think somebody's coming to help us, try and think they're also trying to respond to another 30 to 40 states as well. If we detect infection in 2 herds in a major livestock producing state, 10 days later, 500 herds could be infected, 268 herds could be halted for slaughter, and the infection could spread to 12 states within these 5 days if national stop movement is not declared. Secretary of Agriculture Ann Veneman side by side, participating in a national war game at the National War College in Washington, D.C. We built a model for them at the Secretary of Defense's request. That's right, the Secretary of Defense requested this because he is concerned, and the Department of Defense is concerned about how national diseases in the animal area could compromise the military's capability to protect our country. The Secretary of Defense sees what we do in this room as part of the critical infrastructure of our country. That exercise was called Silent Prairie. 15 members of Congress, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, National Guard, FEMA, FBI, USDA, all participated. It's an example of an exercise on a national level that got Congress involved and Joint Chiefs of Staff. All these people now are saying that what you do in this room is of national significance and is part of the critical infrastructure of our country. Why is it important? Johns Hopkins University declares the 5 high potential biological weapons, and 4 of those, you can see the last 4 on this slide, botulism, plague, tularemia, and anthrax, all are within the animal realm. Smallpox is the only one that's not. As it relates to a terrorist event, this is pictures of botulism. We could see this on our farms, animals that can't pull their tongue in their mouths, that have drooping necks, for instance, as you see in these pictures. That could be just a natural event. Botulism can occur naturally. But if we understand it could also be a terrorist event, we might get the jump on an understanding that we do have a terrorist event going on in our country. We might be the first people to see it because we understand what we're looking for. Same thing with the plague, as you can see in these pictures, tularemia. Yersinia pestis, and in this picture, the rabbits with tularemia, and the human eye form. These are zoonotic diseases that affect both humans and animals. And then the last one is something that we see, anthrax. Again, it could be an accidental case. We do see this, but then we need to be prepared to be seeing this as well since 9/11 as an intentional introduction. As part of this simulation that we put together, we do lots of these different simulations. This is an example of 6 outbreaks in North Carolina of foot and mouth disease. We've calculated the manpower needs associated with this and come up with a figure of 24,634 people per day that would be needed at the height of a cleanup program for foot and mouth in our state. Imagine where we're going to get that 24,000 people from. It's not going to come from USDA. It's not going to come from the state. You can imagine how the resources will have to come from the people in this room and all the folks that you can participate with us to prepare prior to an event. These, again, are the county animal response teams that we've put together. This is the country, and this is the way that it's broken up by FEMA in 10 different regions. There's also something called EMAC, Emergency Management Assistance Compact, where states share resources with other states. And on this map, you can see the dark green counties say that our states say they have a plan completed, and the light green ones say they are in process of developing a plan, and the pink ones or the red ones say they don't have a plan yet or it's not published yet, at least. Just like the picture I showed you of our different counties, and we're trying to get the counties further and further developed, we need to be in a position where we're actually getting our states further and further developed so we can share resources one state with the next, because if we're going to need that many people, we're going to need to be able to share state to state, county to county, these kinds of assets. Here's an example in a beef cow operation. You can see different folks in different uniforms in this. This is a training we put together back in December. You can see the VMAT folks, veterinary medical assistance teams from the U.S. Public Health Service, are in this cow barn. You can see the folks from the U.S. Army, Veterinary Corps, folks from the vet school, local veterinarians, local practitioners, all participating in training, preparing for these sorts of things so that we can share these sorts of resources, one state, the next, one county, with the next. Obviously, how do you prevent such a disaster? It's all about biosecurity. It's all about reducing your risk and your threat. We want to do 3 things. I like this: lock, limit, and light. they do a threat assessment. We've got on our website, Emergency Programs website, an example of a threat assessment document. Here's an example of just one page in that threat assessment document, on-site hazards. You ask yourself these different questions, and then you rate what level of vulnerability you have. It's a self-assessment tool. You can use this and evaluate your facilities in terms of the terrorist threat. Then when you add up all the numbers for each component, then you get an overall threat of your facility. It's just a tool that you can then share with your local law enforcement and educate them as to what level of threat you think you are as an individual producer, as a producer, or as a feed mill, or as a processing facility in your particular state. One of the things we do is we put together a set of laws in North Carolina to protect the data that we gather. We gather this threat assessment data, we gather any kind of laboratory data, medical data. We have a set of laws in place in North Carolina. We've had these, the first ones for about 10 years, but last year we actually strengthened those laws post 9/11 to protect that data from freedom of information. We need to be able to gather data so we can know what the risks are, so we don't need to be in a position where we're sharing our risk with the public so the terrorists can begin to see what that is. So our legislature has given us that capability, and I encourage you in your state to obtain that same sort of ability. It's not hiding information from people. It is the need to know medically related information. It's keeping sensitive information out of terrorist hands. Here's our Commissioner of Agriculture, Meg Scott Phipps, and our state veterinarian, David Marshall, in emergency management in North Carolina, preparing for a foreign animal disease. We don't practice it. In the agricultural department, we go over to the state emergency management operations center and practice there. We've got to be fully engaged with state emergency management, with state public health, with state office of emergency medical services, and every different state agency has to be fully engaged. And the way to do that is to do it again through your state emergency management facility. In this room as well, are the representatives of our cattle association in North Carolina. We've got to prepare, as you can see, not just for natural hazards, but also for things that could create a hazmat event. It could be a dirty bomb, for instance, a dirty nuke. And so who's going to actually deal with the decon of the animal? How are we going to determine what to do in a situation like that? And you've got to be instrumental in your community preparing for those kinds of situations as well as training people to deal with that kind of situation. This is my favorite slide in all the world. This is an animal emergency. I oftentimes feel like this. I feel my feet lifting off the ground, just like you can see in this animal emergency. Animal emergencies are all about chaos, confusion, and crises. Three C's: chaos, confusion, and crises. What we're about is turning those three C's into the three C's you see at the bottom: cooperation, coordination, and communication. We want to do this, so you can pardon my pun here. It's also, since I'm a veterinarian, we want to do this so our ass is not exposed to places we don't want it to be exposed. So this whole effort at preparing ahead of time is critical. And as you can see, as I'm sharing with you with these different slides, we can't just be prepared on our own farm. We've got to be participating in our local communities and in our state and on a national level, because these will be state and national events, and there's not going to be the resources that are going to come currently that are going to come and respond for us. We're going to have to be primary planners and preparers of that kind of response. Who do you need to know before disaster? Here you see a long list of different folks that you need to know. Being able to contact the right person is critical. What do we need to know before a disaster? As I mentioned, do a risk and threat assessment. Know your county plans, know your state plans, know what the reportable diseases are in your state. As I said, ours are on the web. Know incident command structure. Here's the place at FEMA's website that you can see, training.fema.gov, that shows where you can get trained both in incident command systems as well as in animal disease. diseases. Know how to contact who. 911 is always an easy way to start. Know the state and federal plans. Know hazmat, CPR, FEMA's animal disaster forces. These are different things that will help you prior to an event. Know what to exercise before an event. As I said earlier, we get stronger if we exercise our muscles. There's a National Animal Health Response Corps with USDA. It's a great initiative of theirs. Participate in the disease problems that are currently going on as an organization, as farmers, and then you get excellent training and you're ready to go. Plum Island currently, that's where the National Diagnostic Laboratory is for foreign animal diseases. Plum Island currently has a training course where two swine veterinarians go whenever they're deployed. Enter into some agreement with USDA that also has beef cattle veterinarians participating in getting that same kind of training. And as you can see, surveillance systems are critical. I mentioned our GIS system earlier. It's not the kind of thing we want to do, trying to find all the farms around an outbreak, during an outbreak. That takes weeks to months. We don't have the time or the luxury to start finding those farms. We need to know where they are and protect the data of knowing where they are before an event. And then an ID system. An ID system on a national basis is critical. We, again, do not have the luxury of taking weeks to trace out where these potential infected animals could have gone. We've got to be able to real-time, within that 24-hour, determine where that particular disease could spread. And again, an ID system is critical to us being able to save our food-producing capability in our country. And that's, again, I'll say communicate with the media. Communicate, communicate, communicate. It's critical. What can you do on a local level in terms of response? Work with your local incident command system. The surveillance and training, quarantining and permitting, biosecurity, euthanasia, disposal, cleaning and disinfecting and recovery. These are just some of the aspects of any local emergency that the better prepared each of us are to know these things and to know how to do these things on our local level and on our state level, the better we're going to be and the more effective we're going to be at responding. I mentioned incident command system. Here's an example of our structure in North Carolina. Incident command training is something that was developed by firefighters for fighting fires. It's not unlike what we would be facing in terms of a fire spreads, and so does the disease, and we've got to contain the fire, so we've got to contain the disease. The Forest Service has taught us a whole lot about how to do this. But then you can see in this particular schematic, and I'm not trying to get you to know everything about this schematic. All I want you to do is see this little yellow places where it says animal industries and animal industries. You've got to be plugged into this incident command structure locally and in your state so you can effectively give direction and advice as to where this whole emergency response needs to go. Again, another schematic. I'm not trying to get into everything about these particular schematics, but just to say that in an event there will be non-infected premises and there will be infected premises. We have to handle those two types of premises totally separate, and within an incident command system, we've got to have set up totally different separate command posts and ways of operating such that we keep infections from spreading from the non-infected, from the infected to the non-infected. Another thing we need to all know is how to do surveillance. And you can see having a phone bank and email set up so that we can do surveillance. It's critical to have your own phone bank. Limit your own farm phone visits. Figure out how often you got to visit on your farm. And verification is very important. And being able to say that all the farms in a particular area are known to be free of disease is how we'll be able to increase movement, effective movements as early as possible. The Surveillance Reporting Center, I mentioned to you earlier. Schedule weekly visits to each farm. One thing we saw in Europe and UK, the foot and mouth, it's easy for the surveillance team to actually spread the disease moving from farm to farm to farm. So what we're trying to do is minimize the number of visits from farm to farm to farm and educate the people on the farm to be able to call in and tell us what they're seeing on a regular basis. Moving from surveillance to tracing, again, I cannot emphasize how important that ID is and being able to ID not just our animals, but where did our trucks go, where did our deliveries go, where did our feed go, where did our people go, These are all sorts of things about tracing that we need to be maintaining records. Quarantine. Quarantine is going to not just involve our farm. It could be a national stop movement if you see it something that big. And how are we going to respond if we can't move anything off of our farm or within our state, say, for 3 days? How are we going to, are we prepared? Do we know exactly what we're going to do right down to every farm in our communities if we can't move anything for 3 days? Here's a bullseye view in North Carolina of how we've worked out quarantines. You can see the farm in the center is infected, a 2 mile zone and a 6 mile zone. If it's a single farm or just a few farms, this is how we'll handle it. This takes people like the National Guard. This is huge resources, lots of people to actually restrict movement in a quarantine area. If it gets bigger than that and we have a whole lot of farms involved, then you've got to actually do surveillance and some sort of restricted movement in a number of counties instead of within a 6 mile area. And once you've established quarantine, then we've got to get on to the business of moving. Moving is how we keep commerce going, and we can actually keep our business of producing safe food, wholesome, affordable food for the people of our country. And so we've got to get these permit systems in place. We don't need to be trying to invent a permit system on the day of an emergency. Here's an example in our state where the poultry industry has developed a very elaborate system. Don't worry about all the details of this slide. I just put it up here to show you that the poultry industry has a very detailed plan for how they would permit movement of poultry products, whether it be table eggs, hatching eggs, day-old poults, whatever it is. And it's not just for diseases in their areas. They've also worked out a permitting system for something like foot and mouth, which would be in your area. One of the reasons I bring this up is because what if there's a poultry disease? It could also affect the beef industry in the same way. So we've got to be able to think through ahead of time, what if we have Newcastle disease or avian influenza in birds? How is that going to restrict our movement within our industry as well? Premises management, we've got to have an on-farm person that knows how to do all these sorts of things. So training ahead of time in terms of persons to take the leadership on a farm is critical. Here's an example of a couple of schematics that show how we would handle a non-infected premise within an outbreak. You can see that we have an on-farm vehicle and an off-farm vehicle. We designate on-farm personnel and off-farm personnel. And we actually shower, wash everything at the head of the road before it comes on. And then we have a shower taking place at the home, and we restrict movement on and off the facility just to one road. If it's an infected premise, it's a little different. The shower in and shower out occurs at the head of the road. There's not an on-farm and on-farm facility. The showers also take place at the farm entrance, not at the house. We've got to designate on-farm burial facilities. We've got to go ahead and determine on every farm in our country where we could actually bury on-farm, because some of these diseases are so contagious that if we can, we don't want to move them off-site. Now, how we're going to dispose of animals. This is a tough subject. There's a lot of people who have lots of feelings about how we're going to actually dispose of an animal that is suffering from a disease. So you can see here, I'm going to run through a couple of slides to talk about the advantages and disadvantages of different methods of disposal. I'm not going to get into the details of this, but on your level, in your state, in your local community, these are tough issues that have to be discussed and decisions made based on the practical ways of getting this done within 24 hours. Remember, we've got to be able to do this quickly. Part of why the UK got behind is they weren't able to do it quickly. So it's just as important to do it safely and humanely, as well as to do it quickly so that we don't infect a whole lot of other animals and cause additional pain and suffering in the animal community. Here's a captive bolt, and here's some of the advantages and disadvantages. It's safe to the operator, but it's slow, and it requires restraining the animal. Firearms, we've looked at this. We've actually practiced with these fragmented bullets. These are non-ricocheting bullets. It's a little more dangerous, obviously. You've got to be very close right at the animals, but it is. very helpful in large numbers of poultry and in swine, but also we're experimenting with doing it in dumpsters full of animals. You can see the advantages and disadvantages here. One is advantages, you don't have to handle each individual animal. Injectables, again, the advantages and disadvantages. It's not so important that we actually work out at a meeting like this what's the best way, because it's going to be different in different situations, different sizes of animals, different numbers of infected animals. But it's very important that we work this out right down to the local level in each of our states. Another critical issue is pre-exemptive culling. Determining what animals actually need to be culled, these are some of the factors associated with it. How dense are the animals? If they're very dense, then the disease could spread much more rapidly, and we would therefore be in a position where we would actually try to build a fire break by taking out some animals from around an infected area so that the disease would not spread. Indemnity. There's recently been a USDA's put out a new set of regs on indemnity, and I encourage you to look at that carefully. You can see that there's problems that we don't. There's no coverage for production losses, and those are critical concerns to each of us in this room. Another issue that's got to be worked out by each of us on the local level is disposal. I mentioned earlier our number one preferred method is burial on the farm. We say it's got to be covered by 3 feet of dirt. That's even by mounding. If it's a high water table, we're looking at ways to actually mound above ground. It's a method of composting. It's very effective. And we GPS those sites. Again, we're working with all the different regulatory officials in our states, but they've got to understand this is an emergency. This is not a day in and day out problem. Composting, again, I said, was an excellent way. Incineration is much more difficult, and it can spread diseases by bringing stuff on off the farm. It's very expensive. It's 25 or 50 times more expensive than burial. Another issue. It's slow. It's very expensive. And then rendering. It's great, but you can easily exceed the capacity of the renderers. If it's a natural disaster, they can be actually down themselves. So these are some of the different considerations. The point of our being together today is work this out ahead of time, all the way down to your local level. And then slaughter. The whole issue of what animals are actually going to be disposed of. Can you consume? What's safe to consume? What about vaccine? What about wildlife? And then finally, recovering. How are we going to recover? Business continuity says, how do you return things to normalcy? And so you can see here, in our state, we decon within 30 days. We put sentinels back out there. We test negative and we look for contact. Just a couple of tidbits as I wind down here. I want to talk about pre-bid contracting for euthanasia, burial, and decon. What we've done, as you can see in this upper slide, is we've got together the different contractors, major logistical contractors in our state. We brought them together and we developed contracts for all three of these different areas. And we got them to participate with us to develop what these procedures will look like. And actually are in the process of pre-awarding on a state level contracts for major logistical folks to actually do these three things, euthanasia, burial, and decon. So these are the kinds of things, again, a tidbit to you, and they can, again, help you get a jump on any kind of emergency if you've got the logistical folks wound up and ready and already knowing what they're going to get paid to do what task. Then I come back to exercising, tabletop, field, exercises, and geographic information exercises. Can't say enough in terms of a tidbit of how valuable those sorts of things are. State initiatives, it's again, you want to participate in because the event's going to be bigger than your farm. You want to be involved in the diagnostic lab and emergency committees in your state and on your local level. Look at what the Gilmore Commission said recently, and we've got to decentralize the processes. That means we've got to move down to our state laboratory some of this diagnostic testing. We've got to build preparedness and response in a decentralized way. That means local and state dollars from Congress that gives the ability to build the critical infrastructure, infrastructure of preparedness and response to protect our food production capabilities. We want to increase the number of beef cattle veterinarians that attend the foreign animal diagnostic. deaths in farmers, in farm animal diseases, and bioterrorism recognition. A famous terrorist said this one time, Dr. George Habash said, he's a famous PLO terrorist, he said, "Why go after the lions when they're plenty of sheep? Why go after the lions when they're plenty of sheep?" Obviously, we're about hardening our food-producing capability so that we can remain the strongest country in the world. We've got to be in a position where we, through these sorts of practices, and some more that Ashley will share with you in a moment, we've got to be in a position where we turn, every day, turning ourselves from being sheep to lions. We want to be the lions. We've got the capability. Every person in this room has the capability to stretch themselves and participate more fully on their local level, on their state level, and national level to build this kind of capability and turn us further into the lions. Appreciate the opportunity to be with you. Again, I completely respect who you are, and I'd like to be a part of who you are in your organization. And with that, I'll take one or two questions as I prepare Ashby's talk for you. Questions? Neil, it's practical for us to get an 8 point. We use a GPS. We first used a grid system. You don't have to have a GPS system. We did this 15 years ago before we could afford GPS systems. We had a Forest Service grid system in our state. And we put them on grid and converted those grids into a GPS or GIS coordinates. But we just do 1 point. I know some folks are trying to get a lot more information. I applaud them and their capability to do that. That's very helpful. We're trying to be practical. If we can know where it is and notify the people because we know that 1 point is. We also use that point and that number to be our ID on the animals as well. So our identification system is tied back to that geographic location. So we don't have to create a random, unique number system for that. One more question, then we'll get to Dr. Brown. Yes, please. The question was, we've obviously got our plan together, and we've got our ranchers and other folks involved in the industry very well involved. Where is Fish and Wildlife and the whole wildlife folks in the process? I can make available to you our plan in North Carolina. And one of these SOPs that we have is a complete document among wildlife. We went to our wildlife folks, our state wildlife folks, and said, what if this spreads in wildlife, which is very easily could, and would. So we've got a way of doing surveillance automatically. When we go on the farm to look at these diseases, wildlife will come ahead with us right away, do surveillance, gather some samples, determine whether spread has occurred, and then if it's not, we're happy to announce that we've maintained the wildlife population clean. If the wildlife becomes infected, then we have a set of procedures that we take to actually eliminate that infection in wildlife. We cannot wait, in our situation, we cannot wait for it to burn itself out in the wildlife population of a disease because of the potential of reinfection as well as
10 or 12 people that I don't really have clustered here as a producer, or as a government agency person, or as media and report. And let me tell you, that's a positive thing, as Tom began to share with you earlier. You get your media involved because they are the multipliers of the information that you want to get out in your space. That void is always filled. Utilize your media, your responsible media, to help tell the story you want told. If you don't, there will be a story told anyway. And I think, Tom, you said that in some other manner. What states do we have in here? Tom kind of inferred earlier we've got a lot of southeastern states. I know we've got Florida, Wisconsin, Oklahoma, New Mexico, Ohio, Utah, all the way from Utah, New York, so the northeast, the southeast, pretty well covered. We've moved out into the far west. California is here. I don't know who the champion is in California. Tom, you can help me with that. But California has a tremendous emergency preparedness plan. Who's the player out there? Louisiana and North Dakota are here, and who's our champion in California? Do you? Well, certainly. State veterinarian looks like mine. Any other states that weren't mentioned? I think we're pretty well scattered across the country. Virginia and Illinois. All right, we're all here now. I'm going to trust that those of you that are from a certain area will go back and find your sister states in your region and bring them into the discussion of emergency preparedness. Now, let's move forward and demystifying this a little bit, and let me let you know that Dr. McGinn and I both will be here right up until about, as directed by Renee, 11:25. We are to move downstairs just behind the registration area. Somebody help me with this. Delta Ballroom BNC, I believe, is where lunch will be had. And if you haven't heard Gene Collins, even if you don't want to eat, it'll be well worth going. So with that, let me tell you quickly, it's a pleasure to be here, and I appreciate NCBA and Pfizer in putting this together so that Tom and I can spend some time with you broadening our comfort level and our understanding of emergency preparedness. This will, I hope, be the worst slide I'll show you today. It's the only picture I've got of our emergency operations center there in Tallahassee. It's out on the southeast side of Tallahassee in what is now known as the Southwood area. It is where things happen when it comes to statewide emergency management planning. I think Dr. McGinn referred to his EOC in North Carolina. Ours was built in 1992, basically as a result of the experiences of Hurricane Andrew. I think y'all experienced a lot with Hurricane Hugo, didn't you? Hugo that built the system. This building is built to withstand winds of up to 140 miles an hour, and because of that, basically serves as the seat of cabinet operations during any kind of natural disaster or potential peril. Most of the states that y'all mentioned being from have a similar emergency operations center at the statewide level. Why do I bring EOC into this so early? It's because we are managing incidents, not necessarily disease. As you look at this slide, one of your states, or in your state, you'll have one of these perils. show you in Florida, we've got a great deal of exposure. Our state veterinarian, Dr. Lee Cochran, described Florida several years ago as a sentinel state. A sentinel, standing on guard in the Caribbean, in world trade. If you can pick out the map down in the right bottom corner, it's basically the interaction that Florida has with the world. Certainly Caribbean and South American trade are paramount, but as you'll see in a couple of the breakout slides, we question came up earlier, and if I understood correctly, what do you, where do you use GPS for?